Good morning. You are listening to Information and Inspiration with Jen Julius, helping you take control of your own life by finding clarity, improving your communication, and building confidence to achieve your goals. For more information about me and my guest, you can go to consciouschoiceforchange.com and check out the On the Radio tab and blog tab. Today, I have Susie Gruber on the show, and we will be discussing how our childhood survival strategies can impact our success. I'm so excited to have her on here. I've known her for actually many years. I met her when she taught me some of these things, probably about 5 years ago, and now we've become great colleagues and friends. And we're going to really break this down so you can understand some of these concepts in a nice, well, I'll say neutral, even though trauma is rarely neutral, just in a way where we can really understand it and apply it to how it could be impacting our current circumstances and success. So, Susie, I would love to know a little bit about what you do, where you came from, and why you're so awesome.
Good morning, Jen. Thank you. I got interested in this because of my own history, and I studied science in college. I was a chemistry major and just always curious about how things work. And in early in around 2001, decided to really turn that towards how people work, and got an MA in psychology, and then kind of kept searching for what I thought was really interesting in terms of how to help people really get to the root of what's going on rather than just feeling better, which is great. I mean, it's great to have tools and techniques and all that, but I was really interested in helping people shift patterns so that they become part of the history rather than something that we're, you know, carrying around every day and trying to dig out from. So that led me to a modality called somatic experiencing that Peter Levine created that helps people overcome shock trauma. And from there, I found another modality called the neuroaffective relational model, fondly known as NARM for short, developed by Dr. Lawrence Heller, where he helps people resolve the internal conflicts that result from having imperfect caregivers, which of course we all have.
Right. Awesome.
Yeah. So I'm in private practice here in Sebastopol, and I work with people one-on-one, and I also help educate people about how we work on the inside so that we can start to understand the behaviors about ourselves and others that we sometimes find confusing. And of course, this is really important in our business lives, both in terms of the decisions we make for ourselves. And then if we're working with other people and managing other people, we can start to understand some of the patterns we see in other people.
Right. I call it our wiring, right? Yeah. Like how we've been wired. And then if we want to rewire, it's going to take some conscious choice, some effort.
Absolutely. Conscious choice, effort, curiosity, and a willingness to look at some things that can be really unpleasant. And the way that I work doesn't involve what Dr. Heller calls archaeological digging. So we don't go back and dig through specific events in somebody's history. It's much more about starting with what you want in terms of what you want in your life in the here and now. And then that inevitably leads to how these old patterns are impacting your journey to achieving what you want. So by staying connected to the here and now, it keeps everything very much alive, and we stay and cultivate a bigger presence, a bigger sense of presence.
Got it. Great.
Yeah.
I'm super excited for us to break some of this down too, because the thing I love the most about somatic experiencing is the fact that it incorporates the body so much, right?
Yeah.
And I think that reality is often ignored, that the issues in our tissues are real, right?
Absolutely.
That the body holds memory.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel really passionate about helping people learn to track their ability or there's the sensations that they're experiencing on the inside, because they're a huge barometer of what's going on. A lot of times when we have parents who were too busy or neglectful or in some way not paying attention to us in a way that supported our emergence, we learn not to pay attention to those signs and signals. So many people, when I say, well, where do you notice that on the inside? They have no relationship to that question even, and with good reason, because at some time in their lives, they had to shut down their awareness of those signals because somebody wasn't attuning to them in a way that was supportive.
Right. Yeah. And as you were introducing these concepts and at the beginning, you also mentioned shock trauma. And so before we dive in too much, I was actually thinking that maybe we could define shock trauma versus developmental trauma.
Sure, sure. And I'll start with just talking about what trauma is in
that,
general.
That would be that great. Word, let's start there.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Talk
that
about loaded.
Gets thrown around, you know, oh, that was traumatizing. Okay, well, really? Let's yeah. be specific about that.
Yeah.
And the way I think about the word trauma is an experience is traumatic if it happens too much, too fast, without enough support, and we perceive it as a threat. So you and I could have the same experience, and if I perceive it as a threat and you perceive it as no big deal, I might experience it as a trauma and you might just go, oh, whatever, you know. So it's that perception of threat that's really key.
Can I already go off on a tangent
a little bit?
Because this makes me curious then about people. So of course I always think about myself and my clients, right? So if someone experienced a lot of early trauma, so as they become an adult, things that may be traumatizing to someone who hadn't experienced as much is no longer a perceived threat. How does that, like, what does that mean? What does that look like? Like,
absolutely.
If we are in a potentially dangerous or frightening or scary or whatever situation, like we're around a bunch of drugs or violence or something, but we're like, oh, that's normal.
Absolutely.
You know?
And so you're, it's interesting. I love what you're saying, because when there's persistent or chronic trauma as a child where we're consistently unsafe, either emotionally or physically or in some other way, we can develop a hypervigilance. Mm. But what you're describing is actually the opposite, which can also develop, which is a hypovigilance. So if we grow up, for example, which happens for a lot of people now, in neighborhoods where there's a lot of violence, we can be sort of immune to that in a certain way, but there's actually still a toll on our nervous system.
Mm.
And so it's very interesting to think about that in terms of, you know, the person who keeps picking violent partners,
mm-hmm.
for example, they don't realize or recognize the threat, because as a child, they couldn't, because nobody was protecting them, right? So it's really interesting when we start to bear witness to ourselves and the patterns that we developed, it becomes very interesting to see what sorts of trends like that, hypervigilance, hypovigilance, we cultivated. And to remember, I really emphasize self-compassion, because those patterns, we came by them honestly. We came by them because we had to. They were a good decision at the time, and they may not be serving us any longer in our adulthood.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it just makes me think, like, part of this is maybe it's the missing piece of the law of attraction, right? Like, why do I keep attracting this? It's like, well, what's your wiring?
Exactly.
Like, what are you used to? What's your normal? And when we think of things from the comfort zone perspective, right? Like the brain, the critter brain, as one of my trainings called it, is there to keep us safe, to keep us in what's familiar, because what's not familiar can be dangerous.
Absolutely. And so if there's an association between bonding and violence mm-hmm. in our childhood, then we're going to seek that out.
Yeah.
And that sounds insane, but though that sort of conditioning runs really deep.
It's you hear me talk about normalcy all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the only normal that exists is the normal we were raised with.
Yeah.
Like I get all kinds of crazy when I talk about this, because there's so much judgment around, like, well, that's not healthy. That's not normal. Like, what is, first of all? And yes, there are things that we have realized that are potentially healthy patterns, choices, coping skills, etc. But when we're putting a bunch of guilt and shame on people for not having that, when
right.
we're not teaching it in the mainstream school
That's
system,
right.
we're not talking about it. Parents aren't getting this education, not to their fault, right? It's
yeah.
where was it available, especially for free.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. That's right.
And so this is where it's like understanding, as soon as we, in my experience, I really believe that transformation can't occur without safety.
Yeah.
And until we are, say, like shown or told, you know what? Like, your experience totally makes sense. What you're doing now totally makes sense considering your previous history. I want to validate and normalize that for you and help you see how it would make sense. And then we can start to make different choices if you want to and are ready.
Exactly. And you're really, again, you're describing being attuned to in the here and now. Somebody normalizing and attuning to the reality of what you experienced. And for so many people, that is liberating.
Yeah.
It's really, really, really liberating. I'm going to put a plug in for one of my favorite experts on this topic. There's a man named Gabor Mate, Dr. Gabor Mate, who...
I'll double plug that.
Yeah. He's doing a lot of writing and speaking on the connection between misattunement, where, you know, a child wasn't supported emotionally, and childhood trauma and addiction and physical illness and ADD. I really encourage everyone to go to YouTube and check out his TED Talk. It's GaborMate. Mm-hmm. And just go to YouTube and put his name in, his TED Talk will pop up. And he's so compassionate about it and so easy to understand. He takes a really technical topic and makes it easy for everyone to understand. And it helps us understand that these patterns that can so often be pathologized were actually survival strategies.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Oh, it's so wild. Okay. So, I mean, we started to talk about what trauma is. Do we feel like we've...
So that's what trauma is. And then thank you for bringing that back. So shock trauma and specifically right. is a trauma that is related to kind of a one-off event, like...
A car accident,
a fall, a surgery that didn't quite go right. You know, there's all kinds of examples. War... disaster, something where there's a physical insult from the environment. The key there is that the trauma isn't about a person necessarily that we're bonded with. So when we talk about developmental trauma, there can be a physical component if someone was physically abused, but the key with developmental trauma is it's some kind of abuse, neglect, misattunement at the hands of a caregiver who we needed to be safe. So it sets up this very confusing pattern in our psyche and in our identity, where the people we were depending on for love and nurturing and safety weren't. And so it sets up a very interesting series of double binds, meaning, you know, If I do what I love, I'll be abandoned. That's an example of a double bind. I want to say no. It's not safe for me to say no. You know, so all these patterns that we learn in order to survive, or in some way mitigate our caregivers not being safe. Mm. You know, and that can range from anything from really severe sexual, physical abuse, neglect to, you know, garden variety misattunement, where a parent could have a really strong idea about what a child should become. Everything else might be good. They might be living in a very safe place. They might be fed, clothed, sheltered, educated, but they might have parents with very strong ideas about what the child should become. And it creates a sense of disconnect from the true desire. So I definitely have worked with people who say to me, not from a place of denial, but from a place of real confusion, I don't really understand what happened. My childhood was really good. Mm. And so it really underscores the importance of in order for us to develop a relationship with our core aptitudes and desires, we need those reflected to us in a positive way as we're growing up.
Yes.
So, you know, for example, I'm thinking of someone I know who wanted to be an artist. And this person had a parent who was hellbent on this person becoming an engineer. Mm. And so in order to protect that relationship.
Keep, I know where you're going.
Yeah. He chose a path of engineering, which was not his first love. Yeah. And it set up this whole inner conflict of, I mean, we all know what it feels like to have a passion, right? There's an inner drive that's unquenchable. And that's really the source of the work that I do with people, is to help people get back in touch with that and see where they lost the relationship with that for good reason.
Yeah.
For good reason. We need to be in positive relationship with our parents when we're young people, and even as adults, but it's essential as we're growing up.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So deep breath as we're listening, right? So I think that next we should probably dive into, if you think that this is the right next topic, the stages of human stress response. So sure. When a traumatic event occurs, potentially, and this now this is where I still have some lack of clarity. Are the stages of human stress response going to be the same in both shock and developmental trauma?
Sure. I mean, the stages of stress response, you know, that's a very physiological description, and developmental trauma is much more relational. So, you know, I talk about the stress response so that people can understand what's going on in their physiology.
Got it.
It's much more like it applies very directly to shock trauma, and developmental trauma is just simply more complex. We experience a stress response every day. So it's not just about trauma, right?
Right.
You know, I'm late for a meeting. I'm in traffic. I'm feeling anxious about whether or not I'm going to get there, right? That's my stress response in action. The trick is, where's our baseline? Do we ever actually really calm and settle? How many people do you know that live at a really high level of what we call arousal? You know, where they're kind of buzzing all the time, or
yeah.
And you know, and people use all kinds of things like caffeine or whatever to stay at that level.
Right.
But naturally our body needs to settle. Otherwise we're pushing our adrenals, you know, it causes all kinds of stress on our organ systems. You know, we really, really need calming. But to get more specific about the stress response, I talk about approximately five different pieces to the stress response. The first is just orienting. So if I were sitting here with you right now and I dropped a book on the floor, you would hear the sound and you would turn towards the direction of the sound to assess whether it's a threat or whether it's something innocuous like a book hitting the floor.
Right.
And so when you recognize that it's a book, you're orienting to it and you naturally calm because it's not a threat. Now, if it's something that is a threat and it's something that's happening slowly enough that this is possible, you might try to actually engage with the person. So you might, you know, how many of us have talked our way out of a traffic ticket, for example, right? That's a threat, right? That's a threat. And we're socially engaging with the officer to try to resolve the threat. And if we're lucky, it works. And this is the sort of thing that you hear about where, you know, a captive will try to befriend an abductor.
Sure.
As a way of creating a sense of safety.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
Increasing the likelihood of survival. The whole goal with the stress response is to increase the likelihood of survival.
That's right. And I think we just need to highlight the survive, right? Like that's
survive,
what
survive, survive.
The body, and that's like that. And it's our animalistic instinct, right?
Exactly. Lizard
yeah.
brain.
Yeah.
We share that part of our brain with every reptile.
Yeah.
And so that can feel really out of our control.
Mm.
So if there's a serious threat, we'll go into fight or flight, you know, and most of us have a predilection to one or the other of those, or it might be context dependent, and, you know, a situation of one kind, we might fight back, and situation of another kind, we might run away, and that can look like hiding, you know, emotionally, even. It doesn't have to look like physically running away.
And is it so fight, flight, there's two more, right?
Freeze and collapse. And those are the ones that are less commonly known.
Okay.
That's one of the contributions of Dr. Levine's, is that he really talks about the importance of the freeze response when we're thinking about shock trauma, because we freeze when we don't see a way out.
Hmm.
Right. And it all happens very fast. It's not like we sit there and go, oh, I can't get out of this, so I'm going to freeze. It's way more, you know, it's happening at a much more fundamental level than that. And so, you know, if you go on the internet and look for the cheetah gazelle video, you can find this wonderful, wonderful video where a cheetah is chasing a gazelle. And at one point, the gazelle, on a very unconscious level, realizes that it's going to get caught. So it just flops over and lays down on the ground. And in this particular video, a hyena shows up to challenge the cheetah for the prey, right? And there's this exchange, and all of a sudden the gazelle gets up and runs away. So here's this gazelle that from the outside looked like it was dead.
Right.
But it was just playing dead. You know, right. We talk about playing possum. And so that gazelle was conserving its energy and sensing whether there was an opportunity to escape. And then when the opportunity showed up, off it went. It was very organic. And
wow.
And that's, I mean, we all have that.
Yeah.
We all have that. If it really looks like it's hopeless, then we'll go into collapse. And then it becomes, on a physiological level, we're preserving the function, the basic functions we need to keep our body alive. So heart, lungs, brain, you know, there's no energy going to the limbs, which are required for fight and flight.
Mm.
It's much more about conserving energy. So, you know, and all this, there's no absolutes here. So, you know, we can be in collapse in our daily lives and still be walking around. So, you know, it's the person who says, oh, well, I don't care, whatever you want. You know, the person who's not really engaging with the world.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of ways these things can look. So.
Well, and I find it fascinating I know my go-to is fight. And I find it just fascinating to see as I've been watching this more and like in some of the programs I'm in, like for my coaching programs, there was just an exercise that happened, that we did the other day where we were talking about emotions that we avoid.
Mm-hmm.
And I went first and shared like, you know, confusion, like blah, blah, like a few other things. And then all the other females, almost all of them, said anger. And then I was like, let me talk again. And I said, it's so fascinating to me because I totally forget that for like a lot of females, like anger is like a one that they avoid.
Yeah.
And for me, I'll go to it quick. Right. And I'm comfortable with it. Right.
Yeah.
And it made me really realize like, wow, like my primary response is to fight.
Yeah.
And I can totally see like when I look back in my history, like why, how that's come up and how that became a really good survival strategy
Absolutely.
For me. Right.
Absolutely.
Much like, I mean, much like my primary caregivers,
Absolutely.
You know,
Absolutely.
So that's, it really helps reinforce for me, like how much we really do follow in the footsteps of those before us, of our ancestors, right? What we've been shown. I even think there's a sense of like kind of metaphysical biology where just we feel what our parents have done before, right? And how they've maybe survived.
Absolutely. And you're really describing that, you know, most of us have a default response to stress. And again, it can be situational, but I really encourage everyone to think about what that is because you can learn something for yourself about your orientation to the world. And you know, a lot of us are fighting a battle around believing on an unconscious level we're still in our family of origin situation when it's long over.
Yeah.
You know. And that's really the key with trauma is some whether it's shock trauma or developmental trauma, on a subconscious level we don't know it's over.
Yes. And that's where I know you and I were talking after a car accident I was recently in, and you had suggested keep reorienting to when you felt safe after the accident. And it was like a week or two later. And I'm like, gosh, I don't know if I'm there yet.
Exactly. And you know, a lot of times when I work with people, they realize that they've never experienced safety on a body level, right?
Yeah.
They can have the idea that they're safe, you know, okay, I'm sitting in this room. The people who hurt me are thousands of miles away, but that doesn't mean, and this is where the body really is so important. That doesn't mean that I'm experiencing a felt sense of safety.
Well, and then we look at like people wonder why their cortisol levels are
exactly
shot out and crazy.
Exactly.
And we look at some of the people that have manifested some illnesses in my opinion from being in such a constant state of, like you said, hypervigilance, right? Or like heightened stress response.
Yep. And yeah. This is where Gabormonte has a great book called When the Body Says No, mm-hmm. where he talks about that a lot. You know, our organ systems aren't designed for being constantly hypervigilant.
Right. Right. So you talk about survival strategies. I want us to talk about that next. So Susie, survival strategies. Let's talk about it.
Okay. So survival strategies are the strategies that we develop in response to our childhood experiences that shape the behaviors that we experience as adults. And, you know, there's a bunch of different ones. You know, there's the loner who isolates. There's the person who never says no. There's the person who wants to always help. There's the perfectionist. There's the person who always needs to be in control. I mean, all of these pieces can be remnants of another time in another place where we had to shape our behavior in order to maximize the positive experiences we had with our parents. And, you know, a lot of them have positive effects. I mean, somebody who works really hard and strives for perfection and never says no can be a really, really high achieving person. But
that's right.
What I find is that when they reach middle age in particular, that all starts to come apart. I mean,
yeah.
A lot of my clients are in that age range where they either their bodies are giving out because they've pushed them so hard, or they're in that classic space of, oh, you know, I really don't feel satisfied in my life. You know, I haven't really followed my dreams. And mm-hmm. so, again, rather than asking someone to just, quote, change their behavior, which ignores the root of the problem, in Larry Heller's NARM model, we look at helping people actually deconstruct the pattern. Mm-hmm. So that they can organically shift their behavior. And it can really help people approach life in a fundamentally different way and with much more ease and much more satisfaction in relationships, because their here and now relationships are much more about being in the present rather than being colored by relational patterns from the past.
Right. Right. Wow. So, okay, so what are some of the different ways that you work with people?
Well, the most important thing when I work with someone is I'll ask them what they want for themselves.
So, before you go any further, how does that go? Because I've noticed that the two hardest questions, apparently, that I ask people are what makes you happy and what do you want?
Absolutely.
Okay, just
absolutely.
Making sure it's not just me.
No, and see, but this is the thing, right? So what we just talked about, you know, if someone has a parent who has a very clear idea about what their child's going to become, there's the parent has no interest in what the child wants. And, you know, I'm being extreme here. And
sure.
I also want to just really say for all the parents out there, this is not at all meant to criticize parents across the board at all. It's, in my opinion, the hardest job on the planet. So, you know, sometimes when I work with someone who's a parent, they start to recognize what they're doing to their own kids, and they can be really hard on themselves, but you know, whenever the awareness comes, it's helpful. And so the intentions are primarily good. So I just want to put that plug in, but that's where we learn not to want,
yeah,
not to strive. And so, you know, sometimes a client won't have any idea what they want. And then, and then it becomes a conversation about that. Well, what's that like that you don't know what you want for yourself? And then you follow that thread and see where it goes. But it's really, you know, the way I work with people, my intention is to help them connect with their core sense of aliveness. So if I were to have any opinion about what they should do, what they want, I would be recapitulating an experience that they've likely had at another time in another place, and that's not appropriate,
right,
for their healing. So, you know, it's really a client-driven experience,
yeah,
to such a large degree. And, you know, we bring the top down and the bottom up, meaning that we talk about ideas about you know, patterns, that kind of thing. But we also help people track the sensations they're feeling in their body so that they can begin to reconnect with that very valuable source of information, particularly around needs. You know, some people learn not to track their need to eat or their need to rest.
Yeah.
You know, because they've learned to push an effort so hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So how do these things impact potential success, impact entrepreneurs, impact leaders, right? So that's where we were. I mean, the topic is how childhood survival strategies can impact our success. So where does this come into play?
Well, the one that I see the most is people hitting kind of a ceiling in terms of their own success. So they'll have an idea about what they need to do to take their business to the next level, but then they stop themselves for some reason. And so that can be a sign that there's something from another time in another place that's active in them where they don't let themselves be successful. You know, in the case of someone who's leading an organization, it might be the person who doesn't delegate.
Yeah.
Tries to do it all himself. And that'll get you to a certain point.
Yeah.
And then it's limiting. So it's really interesting to help people unpack. And again, it starts with what they want. So someone might come in and say, you know, I want to have a radio show, you know, well, okay. You know, and we'll talk a little bit about what that means to them, how their life would be different if they had it. And, you know, by exploring that, they can start to connect to the core passion around what they're wanting for themselves. And often just by connecting to that sense of aliveness, other things will start to happen. And the underlying pattern will emerge rather than digging for it. And that's really cool because, you know, one of the big themes in the work that I do, you know, because I do work with shock trauma as well. So whether it's shock trauma or developmental trauma, one of the big themes is titration. And what I mean by that word is, you know, one drop at a time, literally only experiencing as much as one can handle. Because if you know, anything that goes too much too fast inside the process of learning about something or deconstructing something is again a recapitulation. If you recall my definition of trauma, too much too fast. So if the healing experience is too much too fast, the person's going to check out.
And remind us what recapitulation means.
Oh yeah, thank you. Meaning that the client's having an experience similar to what created the trauma in the first place.
Right. This is, and that's a trigger for me a little bit.
Yeah.
Like when healing professionals, I mean, I don't want to sound like a total jerk face, but in a way it's like when healing professionals push too much and potentially are just re-traumatizing.
Absolutely.
And I mean, in my work, like sometimes I don't even ask details. I just say like, did an event like this occur?
Yeah.
Yes or no. And then that helps us understand where the energy block might be in the system so we can start to clear it. Right.
Yeah.
Or so I can educate them around like what might be happening in their body due to that. Right. Because you and I are similar but different in how we approach this. And I'm always trying to teach people grounding skills, just getting clear and grounded as a method of success as well.
Absolutely.
But I'm not, I always say, if you don't feel safe, that's always my like disclaimer. If you don't feel safe, we don't go but there.
Exactly.
Period.
Exactly. And this is where, you know, I love what Dr. Heller says about resistance. You know, how many times have we heard someone say, oh, you need to push through the resistance? You know, Dr. Heller's philosophy on resistance is that it's somebody's being asked to go somewhere they're not ready to go. And so, you know, this is a classic internal conflict where you know, back to the example of wanting to have a radio show. If I'm thinking about having a radio show and I notice resistance inside myself, I have to honor that, or I'm creating a split inside myself. I'm actually amplifying my own internal conflict if I don't actually attune to what's going on inside myself.
So when we have resistance, when we know we're in a phase of expansion and what we're going towards is potentially next step towards success, or it's good for us or whatever, then what?
Well, it means that there's something, there's likely a pattern inside us that says when we expand, something bad will happen.
Mm.
Which, again, is often from another time in another place. So that's a place where we can do some sleuthing and understand where that pattern is. And often, just by making contact with it, it'll start to shift. The person will start to change their identity around expansion. So, and then the resistance dissolves on its own. It's not something to fight or push through or push over. It's really something to honor. Mm. And, you know, all this pushing and efforting, again, activates hormones and everything else in our bodies that can really do a lot of damage if we're not honoring the other impulses that we have that we're not necessarily hearing.
Yeah.
So I'm just really a big fan of saying excuse me when there's resistance and not pushing myself or anyone else.
Yeah.
You know.
What do you have a process like that? Have you found that different processes can continuously work for us? Meaning, like, if we know that we face resistance frequently around speaking or a certain form of expansion, have you found that certain people can find certain tools that help them to kind of sit with that, work through that, etc.?
You know, the way I work with people isn't so tool driven because we're really about deconstructing the patterns so that they can be fully engaged in what they're choosing.
Okay.
You know, and it's not that I definitely have my own toolbox, personal toolbox, for example, of what to do when I'm stressed. So it's not that I'm poo-pooing the appropriateness of tools, but specifically the way I work with someone is to help them get to a place where the resistance is far less, you know, that it's, you know, it's a ghost of its former self rather than something that's literally keeping me from sitting down and writing a blog post.
Right.
Or I should say more appropriately, and this is the language of keeping it in terms of taking responsibility for my own pattern, how I keep myself from writing a blog post.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. So then, okay. I'm wondering, are there steps then that it's always individual, we know that.
Mm-hmm.
But are there some general steps that we could take or people can take to start unraveling some of these patterning? Like if they're seeing, or maybe we could even talk about it with like an example, a mm-hmm. real example about when we know we're having this, I almost call it like a limitation, like a self-sabotage or a self-limiting thing. That's what a lot of mainstream calls it, like, oh, self-sabotage, right?
Mm-hmm.
How can we start to unravel some of that?
Well, see, and even the language of self-sabotage is denying the survival strategy quality of the behavior.
Well, and that's where I think we need to
start.
Right. And this is where I want to say, like, what we're talking about is important and critical, in my opinion, for expansion. And so I really do want to link it to the mainstream concepts around self-sabotage, fear of success.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people say that people are actually more afraid of success than they are of failure.
Absolutely.
Right. And they just, sometimes people don't always realize that.
Yeah.
And how then some of the things we're talking about links to those things, but of course we don't like to utilize some
of
that language.
But I think you're pointing out, you know, I think the first step is to really, really take some time to pay attention to the language we use in our own relationship with ourselves.
That's right.
I really think that's the starting point, because for so many people, the patterns that they're struggling with include a form of self-hatred where, you know, if a child's in a situation where the parent does something hurtful, they can't protest.
Right.
Right. That's not possible for most children. And so they have to internalize that sense of badness rather than deciding that mom or dad or whoever the caregiver was is bad. I mean, there isn't that capacity when these identities and these structures are forming, you know, in early childhood. And so we internalize that sense of having something fundamentally wrong with us. And so So really, taking some time to recognize our own relationship with ourselves is really, I think, an important step. And that creates the compassion and the softening and the opening to go, okay, there's something under the surface going on here that I haven't acknowledged for myself.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we're just perpetuating the efforting and the pushing and the same old patterns, which again can be really high functioning, you know?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, geez, a lot of good things have happened in the world with those behaviors. But when it reaches a place of harming ourselves, that's when we really have to look. Because, I mean, there's times to push through something. You know?
Sure. And it makes me think of, unfortunately, some very successful people that end up very sick.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you say that has a tie in to the stress response, the trauma response?
Again, I would point to Gabor Mate's work, and there's other people who are saying this too. I love Bessel van der Kolk's writings.
What was the name again?
Bessel van der Kolk. He's a trauma expert in Massachusetts who's wrote a great book called When the Body Keeps the Score.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I mean, anytime we're pushing ourselves beyond balance in a chronic way, there's a good chance we're creating secondary effects from that.
Right.
There might be positive effects, but, you know, and the effects might not even be physical. They might be in quality of relationship, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It can affect any area of our lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
Is there anything else? We've covered a lot of these things pretty decently on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an area that we've touched on that you want to explain a little bit deeper before we wrap up and do our summary?
Sure. Again, I really want to emphasize, there's two pieces. One is that the survival strategies that we develop were for a good reason.
I'm glad we're talking about this.
Yeah.
Well, and my little additional point that I'm just going to interject as you explain this more is we do what works.
Exactly.
And we do what we know.
Yeah.
And until we learn something different and we feel safe enough to do something different.
Yeah.
We're probably going to keep doing what's been working and what we already know.
Exactly.
And for people that know me, one of my deep passions is supporting the addiction and recovery movement, because that's a huge part of my personal history and my family's history and my loved one's history. And in a lot of cases, when we get really real about it, I'm going to get real, real, real out there, but I'm going to say it. Addiction can save lives. Why? Mm-hmm. Because it helps people numb out from the reality of what's actually happening.
Yeah.
And it helps them numb out from the pain.
Yep.
And it becomes, it's a tool potentially that they saw their caregivers using and their community using. And potentially it's the only coping skill they were ever taught.
Yep.
So until we know that, hey, I no longer need that survival strategy, because that's what it's typically quite often become. Mm-hmm. And we're able to learn something different in a safe space, which Gabor Mate also, I believe, speaks about. We're not going to be able to start making big shifts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And addiction, of course, is its own entity and has all kinds of additional, like, you know, components to it. But that can be tied into so many other survival strategies that seem like, why the heck would you do that? Or that doesn't make sense.
Right.
Or why are you still doing that? Here's the thing. As adults, if we've never again learned something different, we might keep doing what worked when we were young.
Absolutely. And I just want to continue with that thought and say that the origin of the survival strategy was to improve connection with the caregivers, right? Mm-hmm. That's the goal. The unconscious goal when these strategies develop. And so underneath everything that we do, there's a desire for more meaningful connection, for more meaningful relationship. And so often we're not even aware that that's what's driving us. And I think that's essential in the world we live in today, is to really acknowledge and prioritize that need.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. So if there's one thing that you could really shout to the world and nail down for people, what would that be? Just one thing, right?
Well, you know, you and I've been working on this project, helping people understand that they're not crazy. And yeah. and I think yeah. that's really, you know, what I want to say to everyone out there, that, you know, these conversations can be really hard to hear because you recognize some part of yourself in them. And you know, it can be hard to take that step towards getting help, but the help is there. You know, it's really, there's a lot of people working in this arena, helping people overcome patterns like this, whether it's people working in the field of trauma and entrepreneurship, or people working, you know, in trauma healing in general. You know, the Somatic Experiencing Trauma Institute has a ton of resources on their website for this kind of thing. There's all kinds of stuff being written now. It's actually really exciting to me how much understanding there is around how this works. So prioritize yourself. Know that you matter. Know that your well-being matters, and that this is a time when we all need to stand up and take action. And that includes action on our in relationship to our own healing, because when we overcome these patterns, we improve our emotional resilience, which means we are responsive rather than reactive to what's going on in the world. There's plenty to be reactive about right now, but what if we can be responsive instead and go, this is where I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to give everything I have to that.
Yes. Yeah. Really choosing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And committing to it.
Which is one of my scary things I've realized, right? What's up with that? Well, like, why does commitment freak us out?
Yeah. Well, commitment.
Bonus question. Bonus question. I
mean, commitment. For some people, commitment has a connotation of being trapped. So if a child was in a unsafe environment chronically, as you know, when they were growing up, they're not going to want to commit to anything, because that's going to look like going back to a trap. You know, so feeling an underlying sense of feeling trapped is often alive and well in these old patterns.
I really appreciate that. I recognized years ago that was a big challenge for me.
Yeah.
Especially things with my business too, right? Like, I want to do what I want. Like, I don't want to be trapped. Right. And it's been fascinating to watch that unravel over the years, you know, as I keep moving forward and I keep recognizing some of my patterning and seeing some of my survival strategies and recognizing if I want to shift them. For me, what's helpful too is like being really grateful for what's worked, rather than being like, oh man, I'm so dumb. And that's the thing I think that we want to really nail for people is like, and also if you're feeling activated or triggered by this conversation, that is totally normal. Also, we've been talking about a lot of things that may have hit home. So just make sure you really take care of yourself, reach out for support if you need it. A couple things that I want to drive home is just really honoring, like, your experience is your experience, right? Like, it's valid. Your normal is your normal. And if you are going to seek a support professional in exploring some of these things, this is my opinion. I'm going to see if Susie wants to back it up. The most critical piece is finding someone that you feel safe with.
Absolutely.
And there's actually research. I wonder if you know where it is, because I've seen it, but I don't know. I want to put it on my website. Research that shows that the most significant component in any type of therapeutic relationship, when I say therapeutic, that does not mean therapy. It means therapy, coaching, counseling, personal development. The therapeutic relationship is there to help support change, right? The key component of therapeutic relationship is simply the relationship.
This is, I, you know, I'm not a therapist, so I might be straying into waters that aren't mine to stray into, but, and there's, I was actually reading some research this morning that talks about how a healthy relationship lowers stress hormones.
Yeah.
Like, it's really helping people gain that imprint of safety is so essential to healing. It's so essential. And so, I totally agree with what you're saying about finding someone you feel safe with.
Yeah. That you vibe with. And that's the thing is, like, in something like this, yeah, in the business world, you're going to have to probably deal with people that you don't always like, right? But when you're going to try and like do some deep healing work, right, you need to feel good and safe with that person. You need to vibe with them.
Absolutely.
And that's where, for all, if there's any healing professionals, excuse me, listening, I encourage you to niche down as clear and fast as you can authentically, because that's how you can really help the people that you're meant to help. It's not selfish or mean or something. Like, it's not excluding when you say that I specialize in, you know, men with dogs in their 30s that have this experience, right? What that's doing is it's allowing you to more quickly and clearly find the people that you can serve best. So then the people that can be best supported by someone else can find them.
Yep.
And I've seen, being in the industry as long as I have, it really is the people that click with me, that I click with, that we vibe well, they feel safe with me. The results they get are astounding.
Yeah.
And I can absolutely link it to that vibe, to that safety. I mean, would you agree?
Sure. I mean, what you're really pointing out is what was the missing component for so many people when they were developing, which
right.
is that positive regard, that sense of positive reflection and sense of being seen.
Yeah.
And really held.
Yeah.
You know, felt, you feel secure. There's a sense of security and safety in the interaction.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Susie, I am so grateful that you've been here today.
Thank you.
Where can people find out more information about you?
Sure. So I have a website, susiegruber.com.
Susie with a Z.
Susie with a Z and an I-E, GRUBER.com, 707-888-9646, and feel free to reach out.
Yeah. Thank you just also for everything that you do for the community, like your willingness to share and to teach, because I think that helping, again, it comes back to normalizing, right? Mm-hmm. Like for me, I work in a lot of the communities that have our society throw so much shame at them, right? Like the addict community, the recovering community, and there's so much judgment, and it's like, check it out. Like, you don't know the stories of what people have been through.
No.
And until we can really then also allow ourselves to feel a sense of validation and safety, it's going to be hard to make shifts.
Yeah.
And so I guess one of my dreams is just helping raise the awareness of everyone has a story.
Absolutely.
Period.
Absolutely.
And we're all guilty of still passing judgment and whatever. The brain likes to compartmentalize. So stereotypes and judgments are part of just how the brain works, to be honest, because it likes to understand things as quickly and efficiently as possible. That's where judgment and stereotypes come in handy, right? Compartmentalization tools. But keeping in mind also, as we do that, that everyone has a story, in my experience, is a huge support and a huge help.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That's kind of like my final like ba-bam for the day. So any last words?
Thank you. This has been really fun.
Thank you so much. And thank you for listening to Inspiration and Information with Jen Julius. For more information about me and to check out some previously recorded shows, you can go to www.consciouschoiceforchange.com, or you can like me on Facebook at Jen Julius Coaching or Instagram as well. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being committed and willing to make a change and be part of the Conscious Choice for Change. And until next time, we'll talk to you soon.